Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Big Sell when we come back. You know, Joe Smith starts the day early and having set his alarm clock made in Japan for about 6 a.m., while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work, and he shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. Joe puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan and his designer jeans made in Singapore, then a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then he cooks his breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines. He sits down to figure out his money supply on his calculator made in Mexico as to how much money he can spend today. Then after he sets his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, and he goes looking, as he has been for many months now, for a good-paying American job. After the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, then he turns on his TV made in Japan, and ponders again why it is that he cannot find a good-paying American job. Well, Joe, instead of that good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of private business, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? It's free. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Now, remember, it's entertaining. It's informative, it's educational, and it doesn't cost anything. And you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine, send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, the last couple of programs we've been talking about global warming and the Heartland Institute environment and climate news. Heartland Institute turns out three of these newsletters. One of them is called Budget and Tax News. Budget and Tax News. That deals with primarily the economy, and it deals with the things, you know, like the national budget and the national deficit and the balance of payments deficits and things like that. It's not an economics newsletter like the International Forecaster. It's more of a layman's voter guide. You know, if you're just a Joe Sixpack, you know, driving truck, you know, for Walmart or whatever. And you want to get the other side of the Barack Obama bailout plan or the George Bush bailout plan. Or you want to know where the economy is headed and housing and one thing and another. Well, this Budget and Tax News will tell you the other side of the story. And they put out a third one here called the Healthcare News. And they talk about healthcare issues, you know, like national healthcare insurance and various things that deal with health and health care and cancer and cough. Yeah, pretty straight line bunch of guys over here. They're system players. You know, they pay their taxes and And but they're questioning the government. You know, is the government telling us the truth about this? Now, the government does not lie to us all the time. See, if the government always lied to us, we would always know the truth. Think about that for a minute. You know, if somebody's lying to you all the time, then you'd always know the truth, because whatever this guy's saying to me, we know it's a lie. So it's absolute, it's not true. On the other hand, if somebody told you the truth all of the time, then you would always know the truth all of the time. So this thing of deception, then, is a mixture of the two. It requires deception, requires that I tell you the truth some of the time. Because if I'm lying to you all the time, you're going to know the truth. If I tell you the truth all the time, you're going to know the truth. To deceive you, I have to mix the lies with the truth. And so there's two sides to the story. That's what the bottom line is. So when we get to the big sell over here, government only tells us one side of the story. And the hospitals and the medical services, they only tell us one half of the story. You see, I told you there's 14 cures to cancer, and if you want to check them out, you know, there's a series of programs here on the archives, you know, that deal with cancer. I've done stories on that more than once. And I've counted up 14. Now, I'm just a crummy plumber. I mean, I'm not a healthcare professional by any stretch of the imagination now. I'm just a crummy plumber, blue-collar worker. And I found 14 cures to cancer, just over time, you know, little by little, you know, as time progresses along. I read a story here and I read a story there, and this guy's got this and that guy's got that. Now, the reason I bring that up is because the oncologists and the medical doctors and the National Health Institute and the CDC and the FDA, do you believe for a moment that they don't know anything about those 14 cures? They're just totally in the dark. And this plumber, George Gordon, he's real smart, see. And he knows about these cures to cancer. But the NIH, they don't have a clue. See, that's stupid on its face. If little old Georgie Gordon down here, knows that there's a cure to cancer out there and I report it to you, well, then the NIH knows about it. And so the question arises, well, how come the NIH isn't pursuing it then? How come they're not getting in there and doing something here to help you and me, the little guy down here at the bottom, the guy that's actually got the cancer? Okay, and I told you the answer to that. Here's what the bottom line is. Let's suppose that you got cancer. Now, I had cancer last year. I don't know if I told you this or not, but I got a cancer. In fact, I took pictures of the cancer. In fact, remember, I want to practice what I preach, and so I said, you know, if I had cancer, I wouldn't go to a medical doctor. That SOB would kill me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to treat it with herbs. And so what I did was I used the Indian black salve treatment, and I got that black salve. So you can't get that here in the United States. It's against the law. It's like buying marijuana and crack cocaine for you to have Indian black salve to put on your cancer now. Don't you do that now. So I had to go out of the country in order to get the Indian black salve and brought it back. Now, we had to get it undercover. We had to sneak it in, you know. And then I applied it, and it ate the cancer out. And so I took pictures of it. And I told the wife the other day, I said, you know, I ought to put that up on the internet. I ought to put that up on the web. And because we got it when we just have a lump there, see, and then we put the black salve on, and it eats it out. And God, it gets ugly. And it starts running. And it gets real pussy. And it's got this god-awful sore. And it goes on for about 6 weeks. And then finally it heals up. And then it's all gone, see. So I just wanted to point that out to you that there's one. That's the one I used. Now there's others. There's Essiac and Easter Lily Ovum, and you know, there's the Gerson coffee enema and Essiac, and so it isn't that the authorities and that the health professionals don't know about it, but see, there's no money in it. See, I had cancer, and if I'd have gone to the regular cancer doctor, it probably would have cost me, well, the average is $100,000 for your cancer treatment. This one here, I don't know what they would have done. It was on my jaw. I don't know, were they going to cut my esophagus out? They're going to cut my jaw off and give me plastic surgery? I don't know what they were going to do. And I didn't want to find out, so I stayed the hell away from them. I steered clear of those guys. Took care of it myself. It worked like a shot, and I'm back and on the air, and we're doing our thing, and I feel good, and I'm an old man. Now, I also want to tell you that when I got cancer, now, that was my fault. It wasn't God. God didn't come down and strike me dead with cancer. I smoked for years. I ate pig and fat and blood and just, you know, a normal Joe six-pack, just like all the rest of you people. And I gave myself cancer over time. And, you know, one day the chickens came home to roost, and then I woke up one day and said, oh, my God. Well, I'll tell you, when you got this lump growing on your jaw, that's a sobering experience. All you people out there that have cancer, you know, listening to me right now, by God, that's a sobering experience, you know, when you get that diagnosis, ain't it? Well, that'll wake you up. So then you got to make a choice. You know what I mean? You know, we gotta decide. Well, what are we gonna do now? You know, you're already, you know, your chicken's in the pot now. We're gonna boil it up and eat it, or what? What are you gonna do here? So there's two sides to the story. Now, there's the conventional side, and then there's the other side. And so what I like to do is investigate the other side. Hell, I don't need to tell you about the government side. Brian Williams, you know, on NBC, he reports that government side to you every day. Jim Lehrer on PBS, he reports the government side to you every day. And then there's Katie and Charlie. You know, they're all reporting what the government wants you to know and what the government wants you to hear and what the CDC and all the paid professionals know. Now, there's another side to the story, and that's what the underground press is all about. And so this is a variation, this budget and tax news, this is a variation of the underground press. And this underground press, you know, it has its radical right, and then it's got its center, and then it's got its left wing. That's the underground press. And then you've got the above-ground press. You know, you got the right, the center, and the left. Time Magazine is to the left. And I guess U.S. News and World Report would kind of be in the center, you know, and then the National Review would be on the right, you know, their mainstream. Rush Limbaugh, see, he's a conservative, mainstream Republican, and then there will be some radical leftist guy over here like Barack Obama, see, the guy you just elected president, opposite ends of the polls, and then there's some people that are kind of in the middle. And so Americans, they like to pick these people that are kind of in the middle, you know, not too far to the left, not too far to the right. Unfortunately, all of these people subscribe to the same processes that cause us the problem to start with. For instance, the right, the center, and the middle all subscribe to banks, banking, credit cards, credit, debt, usury, interest, and paper money. So there's really no choice there. So some guy like me comes along and I say, you know what you people need to do is to get rid of the Federal Reserve, the income tax, paper money, shut all that crap down and go back to the Ten Commandment model. Now, that's going to be about as popular as AIDS at an office Christmas party. Now, wouldn't you agree? So that isn't going to go anywhere, but I'm not here trying to persuade you that I'm right and you're wrong. I'm just here to give you a report and let you decide what the hell you want to do with it. So I wanted to pick up the budget and tax news, and let's take a look at an article. It's on page 3, and it's entitled, New Jersey Cigarette Tax Hike Reduces Revenues Again. Now, that doesn't sound very intelligent, does it? New Jersey Cigarette Tax Hike Reduces Revenues Again. So, the word again tells me they've done this before. They have reduced their revenues before by raising their cigarette tax. How in the hell can that happen? Let's think about that. You're charging, you know, $1 a pack for cigarettes. And then let's say 25 cents of that is tax. So we're going to raise the tax by 25 cents. So we're going to raise the price of cigarettes to $1.25. And so now we're going to collect 50 cents in tax instead of 25 cents in tax. How in the hell is that going to reduce our revenue? Looks like it's going to double our revenue, doesn't it? And that's what it appears to be. And that's what you're told, you know, when we go to pass this. In fact, President Obama just did this yesterday. I was watching the Lehrer News Hour last night. And there was some program. They wanted to insure little children. They needed insurance. I'm not quite sure why little children need this insurance, but for some reason they do. Well, the government told us they did, so obviously they need this insurance. And so they got it's $30 billion a year. I think that was the number I heard, $30 billion. And if 30 isn't the right number, you know, I mean, we're getting to the point now where we're throwing billions and billions around, you know. Everett Dirksen, he said one time years ago, he said, you know, a few billion here and a few billion there, and pretty soon we're talking about real money. Well, this is $30 billion, as I recall. Now they got to come up with a plan to raise that $30 billion. Where are we going to get it? And say they just raised the federal cigarette tax by $1 a pack. Now I'm an old timey smoker. You know, I used to smoke for years, and I enjoyed every puff. I want to let you know that. By God, I never smoked a bad Roy Tan. I thought they were all good. Anyway, that's a dollar a pack. Now, there's 10 packages for all of you Baptists out there. There's 10 packages of cigarettes in a carton. Now, when I started smoking, a carton of cigarettes was $1.89 a carton. And cigarettes were about 20, 25 cents a pack. They used to be 20 cents a pack, and I think they went up to 25, and then they went to 30. When they got to 30, I quit smoking. Too cheap to pay 30 cents for a pack of cigarettes, which would have meant cigarettes were $3 a carton, you know what I mean, or less. Today, I don't know what they are because I don't buy them anymore, but today I've heard people telling me that they're paying for Marlboros now, they're paying $3.50 a pack. Is that what I heard the other day? Now they're going to raise it $1, so that's going to be $4.50 a pack. You know, well, you know, pretty soon the state will jump in there and they'll put another, it'll be $5 a pack. Now, at $5 a pack, 10 packs, $50 a carton. $50 a carton. Now, I don't know if you're aware of this, but in North Carolina, they don't have any taxes on the cigarettes. See? And so, or they're very low. And so, people go down there from New York City and New Jersey and places like that, and they load up the trunk of their car with cigarettes and bring them back. And then they don't smoke them all themselves. They bring them back and they sell them to their friends. And then the Indians get in on the act. See, the Indians, they don't have to pay tax. So the Indians buy those cigarettes from Leggett and Myers or R.J. Reynolds, and they take them out to the reservation, and they sell them on the reservation. So people go to those Indian smoke shops, they call them, and they buy those cigarettes at discount prices because the Indians aren't paying the taxes on it. All right. Now, did you know that pharmaceutical companies all sell marijuana? Yeah, they do. They don't call it marijuana. They've got their trade names that they put on it, you know. Okay, they all sell cocaine. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but all of the pharmaceutical companies, Merck and Pfizer and all the companies, they sell cocaine. They don't call it cocaine. They don't call it crack. They don't call it crank. See, they've got their own name they put on there. And they all sell heroin. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but all these pharmaceutical companies sell heroin. They don't call it heroin. See, they got another name they hang on that. They got their trade names and their product labels and so on. Now, the drug dealers who sell these drugs, cocaine, heroin, and marijuana, for the drug companies, they're called medical doctors. In case you didn't know, now you do. They're called medical doctors. On the street, we call them drug pushers. In the clinics, we call them medical doctors. And they're all selling the same thing now. Ain't a dime's worth of difference. Except that the pharmaceutical industry says that their drugs are clean. And it's nice to know that when you get your drugs from your medical doctor, that your drugs are clean, whereas when you buy them on the street, they may be dirty drugs. But I should also point out that the medical doctors, those are the legal medical doctor drug pushers, kill 130,000 Americans a year with clean drugs. That's 130,000. Write that down. Now, the drug pushers that are out on the street corners selling drugs, sell dirty drugs, they kill 6,000 Americans a year with their dirty drugs. Now, I'm not an expert on drugs, legal or illegal, but it looks like to me, just from the statistics here that I get from the CDC, you know, and the FDA, like I said, if you can't trust your government, who can you trust? Looks like to me that the licensed clean medical doctor drug pushers are killing 124,000 more Americans every year than are the dirty drug pushers on the street. Now, if that's the conclusion that you want, I mean, if that's the outcome that you're looking for, I would stick with the licensed medical doctors. I think they got a better product. Kills more people. Does it legally. Okay. Now, if that isn't the result you want, and you wanted fewer and fewer deaths, then I would recommend the drug pusher on the street because he kills fewer people. He's not as skilled, doesn't have the ability, doesn't have the training to kill the way the medical doctors do. So that's the outcome that you get. Now, the reason I bring that to your attention is that if the New Jersey cigarette tax hike reduces revenues again, well, then if you want more and more reduced tax revenue, I think you should raise the cigarette tax higher yet. I mean, if a dollar a pack is good and that will reduce revenue, and if that's the outcome you're looking for, then wouldn't $2 a pack tax reduce revenue even further? Now, it was my understanding. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Send me an email here. It was my understanding that the purpose for raising the tax is to raise more money to pay for more government services. Now, I thought that was the purpose behind it. So if raising the cigarette tax reduces the overall revenue, then isn't that counterproductive? Isn't that the opposite of what you want to do? All right, that's what I thought. And that doesn't really take a whole lot of brains to figure that out. I don't think you have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out, now, do you? All right. Now, for the second straight year, evidently they did this last year. Now, for the second straight year, state receives less revenue after hiking the tax rate. So here's the story. For the second consecutive year, New Jersey has unintentionally shattered the conventional wisdom on cigarette tax increases, and that is that higher taxes serve the dual and seemingly opposite purposes of reducing and exploiting cigarette consumption. Higher taxes and cigarette prices prompt some smokers to quit. But most smokers, so the wisdom goes, accommodate higher prices. The total number of smokers shrinks while the government reaps higher tax revenues from the remaining smokers. Now, New Jersey's experience, however, proves this dynamic has its limits. Last year, New Jersey became the first state to see an actual reduction in cigarette tax revenues in the same year the tax rate increased. In fiscal year 2007, the year the tax rate was increased, the cigarette tax raised $22 million less than the previous year. Now, conventional wisdom was proven wrong. A tax increase does not result inevitably in a revenue gain. Now, the revenues have gone down again, and conventional wisdom also holds that while total cigarette sales might fall in the first year of a tax hike, they will stabilize or rebound in the succeeding year. That assumption has been proven wrong also. In the second year following New Jersey's most recent tax hike, Total sales continued to decline, as did tax revenues. So as a result of tax increase, New Jersey actually lost $24 million in revenues. The anti-smoking hysteria that infects many high tax advocates blinded them to economic realities. Let me read that again. The anti-smoking hysteria that infects many high tax advocates blinded them to the economic realities. They believed only a small portion of smokers were price sensitive. In fact, many smokers are price sensitive. Some quit, but more opt to shop in cheaper venues. I'm going to underline that. Many of these smokers will opt to shop in cheaper venues. Now let's go back to the drugs. When you go to your local doctor to buy marijuana, don't ask for marijuana. What you want is Valium or something like that. See? Now, your doctor will recommend that you go to Rexall or Oscobetri to buy your prescription. And when you do, you will pay double, that is double, D-O-U-B-L-E, double, what you will pay for the dirty marijuana down on the street corner from the drug pusher. Same thing with cocaine and heroin. See, so anytime that you're buying legal drugs from a medical doctor, from Pfizer, Merck, and the rest of the big outfits over here, you're going to pay twice as much as you will down on the street corner. The war on drugs is not a war on Pfizer and Merck. It's a war on the guy selling drugs down on the street corner. That's the guy we want to put out of business. And that's because that sucker down there on the street, that scab, that non-union scab, pushing drugs down on the street corner, is selling them for half price. Now, what in the hell is that going to do for business? See, it's going to double, triple, or quadruple sales, because the lower the price, the more people that can afford to buy it. Got that? Now, I want to pass something on to you over here. Marijuana is the biggest agricultural crop grown in the United States, in spite of the fact that it's illegal and in spite of the fact that Congress doesn't offer any subsidies, set-aside programs, or price supports. So they sell more dollars worth of marijuana than wheat farmers sell wheat, or corn farmers sell corn, or soybean farmers sell soybeans, or cotton farmers sell cotton. Sell more marijuana. And they sell it for half what it's being sold for down at Rexall. I just wanted to point that out to you. And I want to point out that the cigarettes are headed in that direction. At some point in time, I mean, if you want to bring it on sooner, then I would recommend that we raise the tax. Hell, let's get on with the program here. Instead of raising the cigarette tax by a dollar, let's raise it by $10 a pack. And let's put the price of a carton of cigarettes around $150 or $200 a carton. And then let's see how much money we make off of them. I think what you're going to do there is that you're going to have people in Colombia and Venezuela and Peru and all around the world growing tobacco, creating cigarettes, smuggling them into the United States by airplanes and tankers and all kinds of ways to sell in the American market. I think that what you'll do is drive it underground, just like you did marijuana. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but marijuana was legal here in the United States until 1937. Did you know that? Marijuana is legal over in Switzerland. I just saw that the other day. Rick Steeds was over in Switzerland, and he said they got a little different program over in Switzerland. Instead of trying to lock people up for smoking marijuana, they don't. It's a lifestyle, and they discourage it. I mean, the government isn't out there telling you, buy more marijuana. But, instead of paying $50,000 a year to lock a guy up in prison, that's what it costs here in the United States. So you catch a guy, he's smoking dope, and so we can't have that. And so we lock this guy up in prison. Costs us $50,000 a year to keep him locked up in prison because he's over here buying his product from this dirty drug dealer down on the corner instead of buying it from the Rexall Pharmacy. It makes government all mad and excited. I don't know. You talk about a big sell. Now, they have sold Americans on the idea that marijuana is bad. Marijuana was legal in this country until 1937, and there was no drug problem in 1937. I never heard of a drug problem. Hell, I was a kid growing up, you know, and I never heard of any problem. And then they outlawed marijuana. Then it became a problem. And you see, the higher you raise this tax, you know, then the bigger the problem becomes. It drives it underground is what it does. Now, remember, this is a report that comes from the Heartland Institute. It's called the Budget and Tax News. And it's just filled with articles like this. And they're not advocating that we lower the cigarette tax or that you raise the cigarette tax. They're just reporting to you that, well, here's what happened. And so, you know, I'm an old-timey smoker. Now, I quit for health reasons. You know, it wasn't just price, it was health and price. But let me tell you, if I was a smoker and I was buying cigarettes right now and the price went up by $10 a carton, I would be looking for a cheaper source of supply. And if some guy came to me and he said, "No, look, cigarettes down here at the local 7-Eleven store are costing you, they were $25 a carton here before this tax. Hell, they're going to go up to $35, $40 a carton here pretty shortly." And so if he said to me, "Look, I'll sell you cigarettes for $30 a carton instead of $40 a carton," would I buy from him? Absolutely. What if he said, "But these are illegal, street corner, dirty cigarettes that you know you're not getting the clean cigarettes that come directly from 7-Eleven. You know, for $10 a carton, what the hell do I care?" You know what I mean? That's just reality. That's just where life is. So if you want to discourage people from smoking cigarettes, I think there's a logical way to do that. Now, I raised five children, and the last, they're all adults. They all grew up and left home, and the last time I heard, all five of my children do not smoke. They don't smoke. Now, I explained to my children how smoking works, and now, I started smoking. My dad smoked, my granddad smoked, my granny smoked, my mother smoked. I didn't know anybody that didn't. My Uncle Buster, Uncle Lyle. In fact, I thought smoking was normal. I was surprised that God hadn't built my lips to hold a cigarette holder. I didn't know. So I started smoking. Hell, it was years later I found out that it wasn't. You weren't born with a cigarette in your mouth, you know. I thought I was. All right, let me pause here for a moment, and we'll remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications. that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Hey, there's one more publication here that this Heartland outfit puts out, and it has to do with education. I think it's called School Reform News or something like that. I don't happen to have a copy here on my desk. I get that one too. School, I think it's S-C-H-O-O-L. School Reform News. That talks about education, costs of it, charter schools, public schools, home schools. I mean, they're into revealing what's going on here in the educational field. You know, costs, you know, how much money are you spending? Now, I mentioned to you here just before the break, and I said, here's what it's costing you to lock this guy up in prison. Let's picture it this way. Let's suppose that you were opposed to alcohol. Now, we went through this drill back in 1920. It was called the Volstead Act, and they banned alcohol. And so what it did, it drove alcohol underground, and then you had the mobs, the mafia and Al Capone and everybody supplying the booze and all the stills that were all over that you see, you know, all over Missouri, Kentucky, Tennessee, all these moonshine operations going on. I don't know that the Volstead Act stopped anybody from drinking. Now, my parents and grandparents were all drinkers, and they were all smokers. Now, of course, I wasn't around during those years, but my parents reported to me that they never had any shortage of whiskey. There was a shortage of beer, but there was no shortage of wine, and there was no shortage of whiskey. Now, I don't know about tequila and other things. But you see, at the same time that you've got this Volstead Act here in the United States and you're outlawing alcohol, they didn't outlaw alcohol in Canada. And so, you know, you got this border up here and they're bringing all this stuff across the Great Lakes, all this booze, and they're, you know, hauling it in. Just like they haul in drugs, you know, across the Mexican border today. They were hauling booze across the Mexican and Canadian borders back then. All right. Then you had all the domestic supply. And my granddad ran a still down at the Needle Rock Ranch. Actually, it wasn't on the Needle Rock Ranch. It was down at Bear Harbor. And it was the neighbor down there. I was trying to think of his name now. I think his name was Happ something or other. Oh, Bill Happy. Bill Happy was his name. My granddad and Bill Happy ran a still down at Bear Harbor Ranch. They're on the Mendocino Coast. And when the price of cattle dropped to $5 a head and so on, my granddad and Bill Happy were just doing great, and they were selling booze. That's the way, during the Depression years, that's the way they were making their living. And then FDR, this is why my granddad hated FDR. They legalized alcohol. They repealed the Volstead Act. Well, hell, now you could go out and buy Jack Daniel's whiskey and any other brand that you wanted, and it put my granddad out of business. And so that's what I was thinking here. You know, if you were to legalize marijuana, do you know what would happen to the marijuana industry in America? It would collapse overnight. There isn't a marijuana grower in this country that wants to see marijuana legalized. And if you did run across one of those guys, he doesn't understand economics. Not at all. I mean, like, the reason that he's making the kind of money that he's making today is because the stuff's illegal. And the minute you legalize it, I mean, you're dead in the water. And see, back in 1935, marijuana was legal. So during the period from 1920 to 1937, when alcohol was illegal, marijuana was legal. So people gravitated. When they couldn't get booze, they went to the weed. And so marijuana use in the United States multiplied from 1920. Then when they legalized whiskey in 1935, I believe it was, they had a problem. People had now shifted, you know, consumer preferences had shifted from whiskey to marijuana. And so it was the liquor industry that went to Congress and said, we've got to outlaw marijuana. We've got to make it illegal. And so they did. And so all that did was drive the marijuana underground. And so now you've got a marijuana business. I don't know where the alcohol business, I guess I ought to do some research and find out, well, how much whiskey are we buying here in the United States and how much marijuana are we buying? I'll bet you that marijuana is a bigger business than the alcohol industry in this country. I just bet you. Now, the reason I wanted to bring this to your attention at the same time I'm telling you about the New Jersey cigarette tax, see, the Republicans in the Congress are advocating, if you want to stimulate the economy, reduce the tax. And the Democrats don't want to reduce the tax, they want to increase the tax, as Barack Obama just did. He increased the cigarette tax by $1 a pack. Let's raise taxes, and then let's spend the money out here, and that's going to stimulate the economy. That's not what history teaches us or tells us. It's probably good politics. I'm not arguing with the politics. I don't know. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't have stimulus packages. If that's what you want, get after it. But I think you're going to spend a lot of money, and I don't think you're going to get very much in the way of stimulus. Now, ordinarily, people believe that the New Deal stimulus packages in the 1930s pulled us out of the Depression. That's not what the history tells us. I mean, the reality of it is, if you take a look at the period 1929 through 1932, about 4 years there, the unemployment rate went to 18%, but in 1927 it was at 23%. And it peaked in 1933 or 4 at 25%. And it stayed at that 23% level until, you know, it went to 19, 20, 23%, and then it went from 23 back down. But until World War II, unemployment was higher in every year that Roosevelt was in office than it was when Hoover was in office from 1929 to 1933. I just wanted to point that out. That's the history of it. I mean, you know, in spite of what you heard, that's where reality's at. So when we look at this and we say, well, gee, we got unemployment growing over here, so what we need is to spend more money, tax and spend more money. That's one view. We tested it in the 30s, and it didn't work out near as well as we thought it was going to. And so now we're going to do that again. Now, as I understand it, and I'm no expert on mental illness here, but as I understand it, insanity is a state of mind in which you do something over again expecting a different result. We're going to do the same thing again, but we expect a different result than we got the last time. Now, here in New Jersey, they raised the cigarette tax. I don't know how much they raised it, but they raised it some. And their total overall tax from cigarettes went down. So they raised the tax a second time, and it went down even further. That strikes me as being insane. And that strikes me as hitting the very definition of insanity. See, we've done this thing. We expect a different result. We expect that when we raise the tax, we're going to make more money. But when we actually do it, and we record what happens, we find out that the exact opposite occurs. Now, that might surprise you the first time. I remember when I was a kid, and I had my very first slingshot. I wasn't quite sure whether you held the stick in your left hand out in front of you, and you pulled the rubber back with your right hand and then let go, or if you held the stick in your right hand and then pushed the rubber back with your left hand and let go. Well, the first time that I used the slingshot, I shot myself in the forehead. You see, I had the slingshot backward. It's true. I was about 6-7 years old. God love my Uncle Carol. He made me the world's number one slingshot. My Uncle Carol was the world's number one slingshot maker. I don't know if you knew that or not. It was my good old Uncle Carol. That was my alcoholic Uncle Carol. You know, the guy that could drink a gallon of wine a day? That was toward the end. I mean, he wasn't drinking a gallon of wine when he first started, but the year he died, he was drinking a gallon a day. Now, that boy could drink. Now, the reason that I point out my slingshot experience is because at age 10, I wasn't the sharpest marble in the drawer, as was evident by the fact that I shot myself in the forehead with my slingshot. But I was not insane. And I could see right away, from the pain, anguish, and suffering that I suffered from the big bruise from that big rock that hit me in the forehead. I could tell right away that was the improper use of a slingshot. Now, I got to tell you, I still didn't know how to use it. I wasn't experienced or skilled in slingshot use, you know, like old David killing Goliath. But I can tell you, I never done that trick again. All right. Now, the people in New Jersey aren't quite that smart, especially the politicians, because they raised the taxes and the cigarette tax revenue went down, and then it went out and they raised it again. Now, that's the equivalent, in my view, of shooting yourself in the forehead a second, third, fourth time. Now, at some point in time, you know, you're going to quit doing that. It may take death after you've shot yourself five times and killed yourself. Maybe it will require death, and it may happen in New Jersey. Maybe they will raise the tax so high that they can reduce tax revenues to zero. I mean, look, let's be intelligent people. If you wanted to eliminate cigarette usage in New Jersey, let's just picture it this way. Let's raise the tax to $1,000 a pack, $10,000 a carton, just the tax alone on a carton of cigarettes. I think that'll stop people from buying cigarettes in New Jersey. I think you could eradicate cigarette purchases in New Jersey, at least from the 7-Eleven stores. I think you could drive all of the cigarette business over to Pennsylvania and Delaware. I don't know what the level is. I would suggest that, hell, even less than $1,000 a pack would probably accomplish that goal. Now, the Republicans, on the other hand, and I'm not here advocating that you vote these Republicans back in, those guys should be out of office for the next 30 or 40 years like they were the last time, just from what they did during the last Republican administration. They need to be punished like they were the last time. They need to be punished for 20 years. But anyway, leaving that political question aside over here and getting back to the New Jersey cigarette tax hike, let's take a look at black market buyers, okay? It's outrageous that an organization dedicated to discouraging smoking among minors promotes a tax policy that makes cigarettes more accessible to teenagers. The cigarette black market, which is a byproduct of New Jersey's high tax, caters to minors searching for cheaper cigarettes and sellers who don't ask to see proof of age. This anti-smoking lobby may be well-meaning, but its tax agenda is counterproductive. Its advocacy of a high cigarette tax is exporting New Jersey tax revenues to the other surrounding states. High taxes also are undermining anti-smoking efforts, and they're jeopardizing the welfare of New Jersey residents. The cigarette black market not only makes it easier for teenagers to buy cigarettes, it provides a relatively easy source of income for organized crime and urban gangs. Okay, are you watching this? So here's what organized crime does. They say, God, this is getting to be good now. See, you got these teenagers over here. I don't know about you, but were you ever a teenager? I was. I was a teenager one time. Now, maybe some of you people bypassed that. But, you know, as a teenager, I had to go out and smoke and drink. You know, kids have to learn. And so, fortunately for me, my daddy taught me how to smoke and drink. He was a smoker. He was a drinker. And he taught me how to do that. And I think that was a pretty good move because I learned how to smoke and drink from a professional, my parents. I didn't learn that from my peers. I didn't learn that behavior from a bunch of pimply-faced punks, as my dad used to call them, my friends. He called them a bunch of pimply-faced punks. He didn't think too much of my friends, my choice of friends. And looking back on it, he was probably about half right. He might have been more right than that. But moral of the story is most young people, though, learn those habits from their friends. And teenagers, you know, if they're not taught by you, they want to learn how to smoke. And so their friend is over here smoking a weed that cost him $9 for this cigarette. See? Well, at the rate of tax that they're trying to put on here. See? And so they're looking for a cheaper source of supply. Now along comes the mafia. And then go down to North Carolina and buy these cigarettes, you know, for about $3 or $4 a carton and bring them up there and sell them for $15 or $20 a carton. And it's good business. They make a lot of money. And they're just double, tripling, and quadrupling their money. And the teenager now, who would have to pay $5 a pack over here in the 7-Eleven store, can buy cigarettes for $2.50 a pack over here from the street vendor. And he's learning also where to buy his marijuana, crack cocaine, and heroin. See, he learns that you get better deals out here on the street than you do from the government dispensing authorities. How do you like that? So you do-gooders out there, you probably mean well, and I'm not belittling you do-gooders, because smoking is bad for people, and drinking too much is bad for people, and marijuana is bad for people, and I don't deny it. But, you know, let's wake up and smell the coffee over here, and let's get down to, as Barack Obama says, you know, the pragmatic what works approach. And raising the cigarette tax doesn't work. Now, Barack Obama needed $30 billion in order to fund his health care insurance for children. Well, where are you going to get the money? Well, you know, if you go out here and you raise the tax on auto workers, or you raise the tax on bread or milk, what do you think would happen if Barack Obama said, well, let's raise the milk tax. Let's charge $1 a gallon for milk to fund this program. Why, you people out there would go ballistic. That would make you vote the straight Republican ticket in the next election. And those politicians ain't stupid. They know that smoking is unpopular nationally, and that they can raise the tax on cigarette smokers, and the rest of you people out there won't give a rat's you know what, and you'll buy into that. But listen, you know, the guy that's out here smoking, you know, he then has to raise his prices in order to support his habit. You know what I mean? Let's be reasonable people. I'm a general contractor, and let's suppose that I'm out here smoking and my cigarette tax goes up by $10 a pack. And all of a sudden it impacts upon how much wheat, milk, meat, butter, and eggs I can buy. So now I'm going to raise my prices as I'm doing work. See? And on it goes. And any time that you raise prices, then the supplier that's supplying you raises his prices. And there's a thousand ways to raise prices that you don't know anything about. In fact, you're seeing it right now in the food industry. See, they're not raising their prices from $1 a can to $1.25. What they do is they just reduce the amount of goods in the can from 16 ounces to 15 ounces. From 15 ounces to 14 ounces. Are you paying attention to the ounces on the cans? I mean, that's just another way to raise prices. All right, so now you got this economic crisis, and it's bad and getting worse, and raising taxes ain't the solution to the problem. In fact, what it does is it exacerbates the problem by raising taxes. So when the Republicans say, let's lower taxes, they got a good point. Historically, if you reduce the tax on something, you will stimulate more consumption of it. That's all. It's just that simple. During the deflationary period of 29 to 33, when prices went down, the consumption of butter went up. When prices go down, the consumption goes up. So deflation, that is a lowering of the cigarette tax, will actually produce more overall revenue because it will stimulate more people to buy the product. Now you see, what you're doing here with cigarettes is that you're trying to discourage people from smoking. Well, how in the hell does that benefit you? Come on, Barack Obama. If everybody quit smoking, then how are you going to pay for your insurance premiums? See, the politician, he's a hypocrite. He comes to you and he says, on the one hand, he says, we want to eliminate smoking, so we're going to raise the tax. That's a crock of BS. They're raising the tax because it's unpopular. It's a minority of people. We can raise the tax and get away with it. And then we can fund some other social program that's more popular and going to get us more votes. So even if they lose all the votes of all the smokers, they don't care because they're going to gain more votes for all the people that have kids that are going to get the insurance premiums. That's all they're doing. They're just trading smokers' votes for insurance premium votes. That's all. Now, bottom line is the overall effect on smoking doesn't change anything. It changes the buying habits of the buying public. You're going to end up with less revenue to buy insurance premiums. You're going to end up with more smoking. And you're going to end up with less tax revenue. I mean, everybody loses. It's a lose-lose circumstance. And that's the drift of the budget and tax news. Now, if you'd like to learn more, they recommend it. And remember, I'm not on the budget and tax news payroll. They're not paying me to put on this program today. I do that. In fact, I give them credit, and I promote their newsletter for using their materials. This is a copyrighted letter over here, you know. And if I went around here, see, it says copyright right here, 2008, the Heartland Institute. And so they want to sell their paper. That's the way they make their money. They sell their paper. And the way I make my money is I use their material, and I come over here and I tell you the story. So this is a public interest program. And I'm here to tell the other side of the story. It was good for Barack Obama to sell that dollar a pack increase in the price of cigarettes. But the overall end result is going to be less revenue. And you're going to have more black marketeering. And that, all that does is create more mafia opportunity to make profit. If you want to know why you've got organized crime, it's because government creates it. Government creates it. You created the marijuana problem that you got today by outlawing marijuana in 1937. Just that simple. No fuss, no muss. All right, now this is called the Heartland Institute, and their telephone number is 312-377-4000. Got that down? 312-377-4000. Now you can also go to www.heartland.org. Simple enough. www.heartland.org. And you're looking for the budget and tax news, $36 a year. Well worth it. You know, 10 issues a year, is that what they're turning out here? Yep, 10 times a year. Budget and tax news, well worth it. The $36 a year, you know, for the information that you're getting, and you compare that to Katie Couric and the BS that you're getting from USA Today and the mainstream press, for that $36, it pays in spades. Hey, I'm out of time here again. Children, we're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.